Her name is Kate, and she's outright just a babe. Her name is Kate. Oh, and I can't stay away, and I watch her with the girls out back, and she's slithering so slick. Her name is Kate, and I wanna be just like her, 'cause she has ketchup locks and a wonder walk, and I like the way she talks. Her name is Faye, and I watch her run from home, 'cause she knows what she wants, she knows what she wants, she knows what she wants, she knows. Her name is Faye, kept in a secret room. Her name is Cheapskate, dollar denim jeans. Her name is Lose Weight, countdown number charts. Her name is First Date. Just be yourself, don't cry. Her name is Captivate, Devastate, Accumulate, Concentrate, Meditate, Infatuate, Illuminate, Real Estate, Abbreviate, Adjudicate, Suffocate.
Hello everyone, welcome to CITR 101.9 FM Radio. My name is Tatiana and you're here joining me at the broadcasting live from the unceded, ancestral, and traditional land of the Musqueam-speaking people. This is a show called Knowledge Hurts, All Knowledge Hurts, a show about learning from the past. Disclaimer, the ideas presented in the following show do not represent the ideas of CITR or any of its members. The project is simply meant to be educational and to report on the historic events. Today we're going to be talking about communism in Russia and how we can learn from it. Russia has been struggling with poverty and famine throughout the 19th and 20th century. Only relatively recently abandoning the noble land system. The class structure was still strongly present. The poor struggled to survive, while the rich spent time leisuring in the most beautiful palaces. Russian Tsar Nikolai II, the head of the monarchy, was fond of this system and refused to change it. Despite the number of protests, Tsar made little to no adjustments to suit his general population. Let us go to 1914, the uprising that started the First World War. Austrian-Hungarian prince Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated allegedly by the Serbian terrorist group Black Hand. Rude. One second, sorry. I apologize, and We're having technical difficulties because this is my first show, so I apologize. Thank you. Okay. So, let us go back to 1914, the uprising that started the First World War. Austrian-Hungarian prince, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, was assassinated allegedly by the Serbian terrorist group, the Black Hand. Having a previous dispute over land, Austria-Hungary believed that this would be the suitable moment to take advances against Serbia and to reclaim the territory. Nikolai II chose to intervene, as Russia had close ties to Serbia due to shared Slavic origins. As Russia advanced into the conflict, so did the Western Europe. To prevent the escalation of the conflict, the Allies entered the situation, ultimately resulting in a worldwide war. The story of Archduke himself is quite fascinating. In 1894, Franz Ferdinand met Countess Sophie Chotek, and the couple fell quickly in love. Unfortunately, Sophia was much of a lower class than Franz. Despite their social status, they were still planning to get married. Archduke's father, Emperor Franz Joseph, refused to give them the permission to marriage. After much convincing, even by the Roman Pope at the time, they were finally allowed to marry. There was only one condition: Franz and Sophia's offspring will not be in line for throne. Even with this agreement, the royal family was dissatisfied, thinking of Sophia having no worth in this of the family. In the summer of 1914, the couple was invited to visit Bosnia. Despite the rumors of terrorists looming by, they went. Upon their arrival, they took a part in a motorcade around the streets. At 10:10 a.m., as the cars passed the central police station, a Black Hand agent hurled a hand grenade under the Archduke's car. The bomb exploded underneath the wheel of the next car, injuring two of its occupants along with a dozen spectators. Saddened by the failed attempt, the Black Hand went to a bar for a drink. Meanwhile, on the route back to the palace, the Archduke's driver took a wrong turn into the street with the bar, where Gavrilo Princip, one of the terrorists, was. As the car backed up, Princip fired his gun, striking both Sophie and the Archduke. Both died of their injuries before receiving medical attention. During the funeral, Sophia's casket was positioned much lower than Franz's to symbolize her low status in the family. Even at the time of grief, Sophia was degraded due to her heritage once again. As one may know, Russia is the largest country in terms of territory and is fairly occupied. The country had a great advantage of a massive army in the war, yet it became an ultimate disaster. The government provided little to no training to its soldiers. Every battle turned into a bloodbath. Almost every man was immediately shot, killing the unprotected army almost instantly. As things turned sour in the West, Tsar chose to leave the front himself. He left his wife, Alexandra, in charge. Unfortunately, her gaze was turned by Rasputin, the healer for her only son. Rasputin would puppeteer the Tsaritsa into favors for him, such as appointing his friends into the office. The Tsar's committee soon turned into a room of drunks, wasting the money of the crown. The history of how Rasputin came into power is rather fascinating. Tsar Nikolai and his wife were desperate to have an heir, a son. When Alexander finally delivered birth to their only son, they previously had about 3 or 4 daughters. The family was joyous. However, cheering was soon over. Alexei was found to have hemophilia, a blood disease that prevents it from clotting. This sounds minor, but without the ability of clotting, the bleeding of any kind is almost impossible to stop, causing death. Both Alexander and Nikolai were distant relatives of Queen Victoria. Apart from inbreeding, Victoria was a hemophilia carrier herself. Rasputin had claimed to be able to heal the boy. The man believed he was a holy man and almost a god sent to earth. The courts point to him being a real charmer, especially among the ladies of the royal court. Now let's listen to a very related song by the legendary Boney M. I bet you already know what it is.
Something about this outrageous man became louder and louder.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, let's go back to learning about how communism in Russia was established. In 1917, as the citizens grew more upset, Nikolai returned to Petrograd. Right now, Petrograd is also known as St. Petersburg. It was renamed like a million times throughout history, so it does get a little confusing. Nikolai returned to Petrograd. He was met by an unbelievable uproar of outrage, the February Revolution. Demonstrations in the streets became a frequent sight. Within a week, Tsar Nikolai abdicated his throne, and a temporary government took place. It consisted of two parties and had little to no power. In April, Lenin returned from his exile with the help of German government and became the leader of the Bolsheviks. During this time, Russia was still partaking in World War I. Unfortunately, some of the soldiers were found wandering back to their homes. Often drunk, the soldiers were an armed hazard waiting for something to do. Lenin recognized the strength of the men and encouraged them to join the Bolshevik Party. They began to rob the rich, as a party's hidden slogan, to encourage them to do so. Once again, the country was covered in blood. As I mentioned earlier, the government was only temporary. In September, Lev Kornilov, or Kornilov, however you want to pronounce it, we don't care about butchering at this point anymore, had attempted a coup d'etat on the Winter Palace. This trial is now known as the Kornilov Affair. For a few days, Lavrov was collecting forces and funds to storm Petrograd. The efforts were ultimately a disaster. When confronted with his anti-revolutionist movement, he pointed arrows at Kerensky, who ultimately denied it. Furthermore, Kornilov was sacked by Kerensky, who called on the Soviets and the Red Guards to help protect the capital. In November, Bolsheviks consisting of the drunks attempted the same push. Their attempt was much more aggressive and soon turned out to be successful. The group pronounced themselves as the government within mere hours. As soon as Lenin was at power, he signed the Brest-Litovsk Treaty to opt out Russia out of the war, giving extreme benefits to Germany. Soil and agriculture was sent off to Germany for the years following, as the rest of the country starved to death. The reason for this agreement was for Lenin to pay back the German government for housing him during his exile. This is a fragment of one of Lenin's speeches made in 1919.
Капиталисты Англии, Америки, Франции ведут войну против России. Они помогают деньгами и военными припасами русским помещикам, которые ведут против советской власти войска из Сибири, Дона, Северного Кавказа, желая восстановить власть царя, власть помещиков, власть капиталистов.
So now I'm going to briefly translate what he just said in this small fragment. So this segment briefly translates to, comrade soldiers, the capitalists of England, America, and France are waging a war against Russia. They're taking revenge on the Soviet peasants and workers' republic for it overthrowing the power of landlords and capitalists, and set the example for all the peoples of the world. With money and munitions, the capitalists of England, France, and America support Russian landlords who are marshalling their armies from Siberia, Don River, and Northern Caucasus against the Soviets, seeking to restore the power of the Tsar, of the landlords, and of the capitalists. Even before the revolution, there was an immense struggle for food. Bolshevik's solution to the extreme shortage of supplies was just to do it in the most brutally way possible. They forcibly took everything from the farmers, including their land. The land was later split into federal segments. This is especially tragic when you consider from whom it was taken from. The ones that suffered the most were referred to as kulaks, which means fist. To simplify, these were the farmers that were honest and hardworking, the ones that didn't drink and were generally righteous people. Sometimes being a family of several generations of farmers, they lost everything. The ones that protested were eventually put into the gulag system, or working camps. Violence against the captured was far too common and resources were scarce. As the time passed by, people became frustrated with the system. Another class split was inevitable due to the wealthy being treated like garbage. The dissatisfied formed an alliance and referred to as the Tsarists, or the Whites. The collision of the group of the Red and the Communists sparked the Russian Civil War. It was later followed by conflicts between the parties, and once again the Bolsheviks did not hesitate to kill. On July 17, 1918, the Romanovs, the royal family, were brutally murdered in the cover of the night. The dynasty has been in power for over 300 years, but it was now officially extinct. Most sources point to the Bolsheviks assassinating the family to get rid of any power opponents. In 1920, the nation, along with the future USSR states, launched the attack against its bordering neighbor, Poland. The goal was to expand the state, and Poland was pretty much a direct gate into Western Europe. The action was led by Trotsky, the Commissar of Military Affairs. He was disagreed with commands relentlessly, but he had to do the task anyway. The war, once again, was bloody, with estimated 67,000 killed. Towards the end of the affair, Stalin entered the picture. The general secretary at the time, he was determined to use the Battle of Warsaw to his advantage. His tactfulness led to the Polish holding victory against the Red Army, despite being three times outnumbered. Peace of Riga was signed and marked as the state's failure, for which Stalin blamed Trotsky. 1922, Treaty of the Creation of USSR was signed. The original countries include Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine. During this time, Lenin's health was declining. He had three strokes between May of 1922 and March of 1923, which caused paralysis, loss of speech, and finally death on 21st of January, 1924. After Lenin's death, a struggle for power began. Stalin joined Zinoviev and Kamenev in a joint effort to eliminate other candidates for leadership. Soon, joining with Bukharkin and Trotsky, Tomsky and Ryukov, Stalin sent his previous allies to Gulag camps. But what about Trotsky? Trotsky's main idea was to spread the revolution to the rest of Europe, but the rise of fascism intervened with his plans, declining him in popularity. Trotsky was eventually exiled from the Soviet Union in February of 1929. That same year, Tomsky and Ryukov found themselves played by Stalin as well. Within 5 years of Lenin's passing, Stalin became the sole ruler of USSR. In 1940s, Stalin began a massive execution of any opposition, including Trotsky. He was hunted down by the secret services and got an ice axe to the head in Mexico. Stalin reigned in terror, even more terrifying ways that Lenin did. We will come back to this topic after a brief message.
Is rooted in systems of oppression. There's who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression.
There are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work.
Obviously, there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system.
And to be left out
of conversations, it only exemplifies that loss of self-esteem.
Check out CITR's live panel podcast, Conversations, hosted by our Indigenous, Accessibility, and Gender Empowerment collectives. Subscribe to Conversations, available now on iTunes.
Do you want to voice this one?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Do you want me to voice it?
I can voice it. Yeah, yeah. Please voice
That's
this one.
That's the wrong mic.
I forgot.
You f- dip. I can't believe I put up with this. And I asked for a grape soda, you asshole. Okay.
Due to a labor dispute, CITR is missing its star voice actors. That means if you're interested in producing PSAs, advertisements, and various other promotional wonders for airplay on the radio, we need you. Learn how to get involved with CITR's production department and all other facets of volunteering at CITR and Discord or magazine at CITR.ca. Programming, photography, media training, and more. Plus, a guest star in the lounge. No, wait, we can't promise that.
Can't believe I put up with this.
Thank you. appreciate power. What will it take to make you capitulate? We appreciate power. We appreciate power. When will the state agree to cooperate? We appreciate power. 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 We appreciate power.
Hi, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM radio. My name is Tatiana, and we're broadcasting live from the unceded ancestral land of Musqueam-speaking people. Right now, you're listening to the show called All Knowledge Hurts. We're just going to come back to the topic of communism in the USSR. By this point, communism was already established. Now I'm going to go into some more of my family stories because I'm myself Russian. I'm technically half Ukrainian, but no one cares about that. But there are some stories that I want to share with you. But this is, there is a disclaimer. The following discussions may be upset to some viewers. I will be talking about themes regarding death, and they are pretty brutal, so if you're sensitive to violence, please don't listen. You can come back within maybe another 20 minutes. Okay, as you can see, there was a lot of hunger in the story of Russia, and it has been like that for a majority of the history. The previously pattern of hunger and food shortages seen in the beginning of 20th century unfortunately continued throughout the history of USSR. In 1932, Stalin implemented policies that led to the famine on Ukraine due to resistance of collectivization. So collectivization is basically when the state collects all of your belongings and unifies them, like we've talked about in the previous segment about the kulaks. So this is basically the same ordeal, but it's very severe. Yeah, as previously seen in Russia, the hardworking farmers had every moral right to hold on to their land. Soviet has set impossible quotas for Ukraine of crop collection. Brigades of special agents were dispatched to Ukraine to assist in collecting, and homes were routinely searched and any trace of food was confiscated. To add to the fire, a law was passed in August of 1932, making the theft of socialist property a crime, leading to execution for stealing a small quantity such as a sack of wheat from the state. Moscow ignored the horrendous events, and even exported more than a million tons of grain to the West during this period. It really changed the whole community. Once friendly villages were now fighting over every tree sapling, patch of grass, or even dirt. There was an instance where a father hung his children in order to stop their suffering. This level of cruelty is unimaginable to the modern eyes. These stories seem like a fantasy, yet they are true, Besides food, every piece of Ukrainian culture was destroyed. Intellectuals were exiled, books were burned, and even language was banned. Every trace of cultural identity was cut off from the people in the hardest of times. Being a Ukrainian became shameful and was looked down upon. Of the estimated 6 to 8 million people who died in the Soviet Union, about 4 to 5 million were Ukrainians. The starvation continued up to 1945, the end of World War II, which we're going to talk about briefly in a different segment. Just stay tuned. During the blockade of Leningrad, people were given about 80 grams of bread per day. Just for context, it is a small, thin slice of bread. It can fit in your palm, and that's what you got for the whole day. Meanwhile, people died of cold and hunger. The higher-ups were getting imported oranges from abroad. This goes to show, as George Orwell once said in his Animal Farm book, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Even after the period of famine, there was still massive shortage of food. When my grandpa was a child, he and his siblings were often hungry. Their bread was locked up to save it for a mealtime, but they would manage to steal it anyway. One day, his mother was setting the table for dinner and went to the cupboard only to find it empty. It was so heartbreaking, as they really couldn't punish the children. They were just hungry. The sight of the empty cupboard made his grandpa's stepdad cry. During my parents' youth, the situation was a little better. People would even sometimes get extra income to spend on luxuries, but the access to them was very limited. There would always be a line to the grocery store whenever meat was available. Sometimes it would take hours of standing in the queue only to find out that the product has run out. My mom would often be the one to be in lines as a kid. Stockpiling was frequent at the time. As long as something was available, it was bought. Right now, we will take a little break and listen to some Russian Tim and Pavel Bure. They're from Vancouver, BC, and feature some Russian lyrics in this called Tattoo, which does mean tattoo. A brief review of this album can be found in the current issue of Discorder magazine, written by the lovely Kay Roche.
Because at the end of you has opened my eyes. Could I ever believe? hardcore stuff is just is fast, very aggressive and loud, you know, music, angry music.
I am your host, Mr. Steeston Mike. Welcome to the Flex Your Head Show on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm here every Tuesday.
6 to 8 p.m.
Playing some punk and hardcore for you. If you want to hear something, feel free to give me a call at 604-822-2487 or swing by flexyourhead.net and send us an email with a request.
The 18th Annual Doxa Documentary Film Festival returns this May 2nd through May 12th. Committed to cultivating curiosity and critical thought, Doxa will present 82 short and feature films from across Canada and around the world, representing some of the very best in contemporary documentary cinema. Highlights at this year's festival include the 10th anniversary of the Justice Forum series, a special live documentary performance, an expanded industry program, and a list of special programs, including Politics of Place, Communities of Care, Longing and Belonging, 1990s South Asian Film and Video, and Italia Italia, a documentary peninsula. Find the full festival schedule and buy tickets online today at doxafestival.ca.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year but will next year, and to our community as a whole. CITR and Discorder just want to say...
Yes, thank you for listening to my mediocre show with a lot of errors. Okay, this is CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, broadcasting live from the unceded, ancestral, and traditional land of the Musqueam people. You're listening to All Knowledge Hurts. So the next one is my dad's story. So in USSR, universities are free. Granted, there are limited choices in your post-secondary. As the institutes are all government-owned, they're in charge of the program. One of the courses my father had to take was the history of the Communist Party. On one occasion, he said something along the lines of, "Communism can never work." His professor, a member of the party, was furious. She took the matter into her own hands and made extreme efforts to expel my father. The only reason that he wasn't expelled because he was due to leave for the military service. Before he went, she said to him, "Oh, good, good. They will reteach you." Once my father came back from the service, the perestroika was in full force, on which I will touch later on. He saw her again and she hugged him with open arms. She became a full-on modernist and activist in the Gorbachev movement. Service in the army was a big part of the USSR military. Every man aged from 18 to 28 was to serve in the army for 2 full years. Unlike here, it was not paid. The only commodity you got is a bunk bed and a mediocre food. Every day in the initial institute, they were running 5 kilometer laps among the other duties. One early morning, my dad was receiving bread from a trunk. It was still hot and he was so hungry, so he snuck a loaf in his jacket and ate it within a few minutes. The overall training of the soldiers was not professional and pretty basic, in case they need to defend their own mother country. Due to mere introduction of what goes behind the scenes in a war environment, the casualties are much higher than a professional army. Okay, I think... Yeah, so this is pretty much my last story for right now. Okay, here's the context for the story. In USSR and currently in Russia, there are a two-passport system. It's kind of confusing, but just stay with me. Even though there are two passports, almost all of the citizens in USSR had only one on hand. The one that they had was used only within the borders of the state. It's similar to having an ID card that is not a driver's license or a healthcare card. It was just basically like a document just for the purpose of being an ID. The other passport is used for traveling purposes, which was prohibited for the Soviet people. But they were exceptions. Here we go. For example, my grandfather was placed to work in a metallurgy factory in Algeria, and my dad got to come along with his mom. This was the first instance where people got the traveling passports on hand. There was a couple that took off on a plane to Spain soon after the arrival to Algeria. The rumor has spread through the town, and they were soon detained. Unfortunately, no one knows what happened to them, but I'm sure it was on the records. Instances like this can really impact one's life. For example, the only way you got a room or a flat was through the party. The whole real estate situation was a mess, to say the least. For starters, many families didn't even have their own apartment. A three-bedroom apartment would house three different families, one in each room. They would have to live codependently, and they would share the bathroom and the kitchen, sometimes with upwards to like six or seven people. In order to receive your room or to move to a different one, you needed to enter your name in a queue. It might take years to receive your placement. One way to fasten the process was to join the party as its active member. Even when you got your room, you could always lose it. There was a report system in place where you could tell on someone who does anything that is against the party's views. Of course, it was abused for personal gain. If someone wants to have the biggest room in the apartment, they'd report for the family or for speaking ill of Stalin or whoever. The next day you'd move in, simple as that. I chose to tell these stories that you can see that even in small little ways, the system was not done properly. Everything seems completely flawed and illogical. Right now, we will take a listen to some of my currently favorite music to clear our minds. The following song and the previous one that we've listened before are by Psy, a local lady band that has the most lovely tunes. This is Psy, everyone.
is back in the USSR. Well, the delivery girl's really knocked me out. The West behind. And Moscow girls make me sing and shout. And Georgia's always on.
That was the Beatles. Okay. And just like the song, we are back in USSR. Okay. Right now we're in 1941, just for context. World War II was a trying time for the communism in USSR. The Soviet was struggling to keep afloat in the first 2 to 3 years of the German invasion. The borders were not secure. German troops advanced with lightning speed, blitzkrieg. Communist ideas were put on hold. Religion was allowed back into the culture to give a sheer sense of faith to the people. At this point, USSR was doing anything to survive, even if it meant going against its values. In the beginning of 1944, USSR was fighting back, pushing German troops. In 1945, the Allied and Soviet troops met one another on the streets of Berlin, and the temporary government signed the Potsdam Agreement. One thing that is notable is that USSR gave freedom to every nation it conquered by defeating the Nazis. This is not the side of the nation many people choose to portray, as they want to keep their narrative linear. Nothing is black and white in this world, even totalitarian governments. Now, let's jump to the 1950s. This era was most notable by the signature style and the Western suburban lives. Meanwhile, the housewives were busy cooking in dresses, the race was full force. US and USSR began to compete in various fields, such as the race to space and atomic bomb creation. This was fueled by the goals of spreading communism rapidly by the Soviet and the Red Scare for the West. USSR began to involve in other uprisings, especially in Asia. It took part in turning China communist, the Vietnam War, and the split of Korea. Along with that, it was also invading neighboring countries, such as the Czechoslovakia. The two forces met in Germany, splitting the country into East and West side. The country was separated by the Berlin Wall, separating families apart. The Red Army would shoot anyone who would attempt to cross the border. The two forces were now physically face-to-face, and the tension was rising even more. USSR's series of occupations was deeply concerning for the Allies. They started creating pacts against the East. Take NATO, for example. Both sides in this conflict aren't without flaw. USSR was aggressive and violent in their influence of the neighboring countries. Its actions and behavior was similar to a dog with the rabies. You just don't know what to expect. US was justified to take action, but it definitely was an overkill. It seemed like that America was aiming guns with every breath that the Soviet took. The country had habit to militarize the West Germany at any occasion. The whole world was tense. This period deserves a whole episode of its own. This whole situation is just quite murky, and it's not one-sided. It's definitely something that needs to be discussed further. Right now, we will be talking about the era of the Union known as the Perestroika, which means rebuilding. This is a government policy implemented by Mikhail Gorbachev in the middle of 1980s. He implemented his glasnost policy, a policy of openness into the everyday life of any USSR citizen. Gorbachev limited the control of many businesses, allowing previously controlled by the state manufacturers to decide things for themselves, such as the amount of stock and prices. In May of 1988, Gorbachev introduced a new policy that allowed for the creation of businesses within the Soviet Union, with limitations. Gorbachev also loosened the restrictions on foreign trade, allowing manufacturers to export their produce legally. For the first time, elections were present with the choice of candidate, including non-communists. Previously imprisoned intellectuals, including Nobel laureate physicist Andrei Sakharov, were elected. His aims were easing for the relationship with America. There was a sigh of relief, and the nations began to grow closer together. In 1989, the Berlin Wall was torn down that previously separated the East and the West Germany, and the Cold War was finally over. Gorbachev won a Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo December 10th of 1990 for his contribution to this event. In 1991, 28 years ago, the USSR collapsed. Russia took over all of the treaties and agreements that USSR has signed, taking full responsibility. Gorbachev was often blamed as the sole reason why USSR fell apart. This is my opinion, but I believe he was the safety net that made the fall hurt less. Communist regime in the Soviet was bound to end soon, and without his involvement, it would turn into a bloodbath once again. He worked with what he had, and I think Gorbachev made the best of it. Here's a clip from CNN, 1991, the day of Gorbachev's resignation.
Died quietly on Christmas. The Soviet Union, the world's first communist country, born in the revolution of 1917, died quietly on Christmas Day, 1991. Died with the words of the last Soviet leader, who said, "I quit."
I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
Mikhail Gorbachev had worked himself out of a job and a country. But Gorbachev spoke of a grand accomplishment.
This society has acquired freedom. It has been freed politically and spiritually.
So this kind of concludes my insight on the communism in Russia. I apologize, this is my first show, so it had a lot of errors, but I hope all of you have a wonderful day. Upcoming next is 100 BPM. BPM stands for Beginners Playing Music, a fitting name for a space to try something new, play some good tunes, and be okay with messing up and moving on. Quite accurate, I should join that show. Right now, I'm just going to play a track by Lisa Mar and the Transmitters. It's called In the Summer. All right, thank you so much for listening, and I will hopefully see you next week, this time exactly.
You are listening.